people are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you agree that everyone deserves a roof, a decent home, children in particular, and low-income people and the elderly. And yet we're still struggling as a society to figure out exactly how to provide these basics. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, my guest is Dr. Sandra Newman, Director and Professor of Policy Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Newman's research has focused on affordable housing and its impact on the well-being of children, as well as the frail elderly. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for making time for us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Let's talk about your research on how living in public housing impacts children.
Several years ago, I was looking at the long-term effects of living in public housing on adult outcomes for children. So, for example, if a child spent some of the first years of their childhood living in public housing, what kinds of outcomes did they experience when they became young adults? And in order to do this research, we had to focus on a period of time that is not contemporaneous. Primarily, the children were living in public housing during the 1970s and early 1980s when, as we know, public housing was somewhat different than it ultimately became. The findings that we derived from that research were, I think, quite surprising to many people, and they were that, in fact, once we accounted for the greater poverty and other signs of disadvantage among children who were living in public housing, so once we accounted for those, the young adult outcomes of these children were actually better than comparably poor children who had not been living in public housing during their childhood. And the reason I bring this up is that we know that one of the criteria that public housing is supposed to meet is that the units meet standards of quality. And so if on average, and I think this is actually accurate, that on average public housing units do meet housing quality standards, then this is sort of an indirect way of saying that if children grow up in environments where the quality of housing is sound, it is associated with better educational attainment, less likelihood of being on welfare, and those sorts of things. But we can't be sure that these findings are completely attributed to the quality of the housing, because we know that public housing has many other features associated with it, one of which is affordability. That is, that the rent is limited by and large to 30% of the family's income. So just to take those two factors at the start of this conversation, it could be that the affordability of the housing for the family is what's at work here. It could be that the structural soundness of the housing is at work. We really are not sure. What we do know, however, is that children across the country in the 1970s and early 1980s who grew up in public housing did experience better outcomes than comparably poor children who did not.
When we talk about affordability as a success factor in this case, is one of the issues that families can remain in one place rather than having to move frequently?
Well, that's a very good point, and it actually is the whole concern about frequent residential moves by poor families, the turmoil that that creates for not only the parents but the child when it requires the changing of schools and getting reacclimated to a new environment. There's a great deal of concern about that churning being a major disadvantage for families. But this is a complicated question, because it is often the case that families are moving because of family turmoil. And the issue at the heart of the move is really not associated with housing per se, but rather what's going on in the family. So we would narrow down moves to situations in which the family is being forced to move because of other considerations, not changes within the family, and then looking within those situations to the extent that assisted housing provides a more stable environment. And those studies really have not been done, so we cannot really comment on that.
Have you looked at overcrowding? We hear about two and three families being squeezed into small apartments just to make ends meet.
Right. Again, that's another feature that is a standard for assisted housing, where there are limits on how many individuals, and done by age and sex of the children, can live in an apartment of a given size. And so with regard to the findings that I mentioned at the outset, another factor that could be in play as to why those children experience better outcomes, well-being as they began their years of adulthood, could be that they were growing up in less crowded circumstances. But again, it's very hard to tease out which factor is really accounting for this.
Is a child's well-being impacted at all if a family is able to actually purchase their home?
Well, you're asking a very timely question, and because of what has happened in the sort of housing meltdown in this country and many others, this has actually, what preceded the meltdown was quite a bit of research by a large number of very, very good researchers looking at home ownership and, to some extent, looking at the impact of home ownership on outcomes for families and children. And for at least a decade, the weight of the findings of that body of research suggested that home ownership itself, per se, was associated with beneficial outcomes, well-being outcomes for children. In the last several years, I would say perhaps prompted by the weaknesses in housing markets, but really preceding that, a number of us have taken another look at the role of home ownership. And these are very difficult studies to actually conduct, so that the big challenge is to make sure that you are looking at the impact of this tenure of owning a home as opposed to other characteristics, other dynamics that are going on. One of them being, of course, that you may have a group of people who opt to become homeowners, and they are different in ways from those who rent, that also impact outcomes for children. So you end up in a confounding of what it is you're trying to look at. This newer body of research is actually producing, I think, a provocative finding and a finding for the day, and that is that we think that these earlier positive findings really are the result of who it is becomes a homeowner, as opposed to the effect of home ownership per se. So that would say that, for example, families that are more prone to plan ahead, that are more efficacious, more efficient in the use of their time, that are better at child rearing, and that are resourceful, and that are stable, are the ones who are more likely to opt to become a homeowner. And those on the opposite side of the continuum end up being renters. And when you look at the comparison between parents and children in one situation versus another and find a difference, a significant difference, what you're really looking at are the differences in the families themselves, not in the fact that they're owning or renting.
I know that you've also conducted research on the elderly. Eden Housing has a fair amount of experience in that realm. Allowing residents to age in place with supportive services. We don't have any quantifiable research, but anecdotally, it certainly seems to make a difference. Is that what you've seen in your research thus far?
Well, this is another one of those challenging areas, and I have to say that there have been a number of studies done in the past, actually pretty far in the past, looking at the Section 202 program and other attempts to provide services to elderly residents. And the nature of the research that's been done makes it very difficult to actually tease out the direct impact of the services. Now, for many of us who have been to housing developments that have either on-site services or service coordinators, you know, our common sense reaction to this has a huge impact and really brings an incredible improvement in quality of life to the elderly residents who live there. But the honest answer to your question is we really have not done the kind of rigorous research that I think would be ultimately very convincing to policymakers that demonstrates the potentially large effect of these services and really the cost benefit of them.
Can you briefly describe the research that you're working on now?
Well, I'm engaged in a number of different studies, but one of the studies that we've stepped up to the plate on that everyone else has sort of avoided is looking at housing affordability. And the reason people have not looked at this is, number one, it's a very difficult topic area to study, starting from what do we really mean by the concept of housing affordability. Most of us, sort of just off the top of our head, would say, well, it's the fraction of our income that we pay for our housing. But when you're trying to elicit findings that pertain to outcomes for children, you immediately get into a complicated problem of, again, this sort of circularity. That is that as a family, you will decide probably to spend some fraction of your income on housing, and that decision and the kind of person you are making that decision probably also has a lot to do with how you nurture your children, the value you put on good schooling, and so on and so forth. And so it's very circular with the outcomes we're trying to study, and it violates the principles of how you're supposed to do this research. So we have had to work in this area finding some other a proxy representative measure of affordability that is not what the family is doing per se, but it characterizes the environment in which they're living. And we use the measure of housing prices in their metropolitan area, and this does seem to be a reasonable external measure, and it is the case that if you live in a higher priced area, you're much more likely to be spending a larger share of income as a poor person on your housing. So just to get that sort of on the table. Looking at the next step is to use rich long-term databases that have followed families over a long period of time so that we can actually look at what has happened to the child over their childhood years. And at this stage of our research, we've now looked at two very wonderful, rich national longitudinal surveys, one called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics that's done out of the University of Michigan, and the other called the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, that is done jointly between Ohio State University and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And we have found what's important about looking at different databases is social scientists don't often measure up to the standards of the hard sciences in that we don't do direct replication very much. And testing a complicated concept on one database just is not enough. So we have now tested this on two different databases and derived the same conclusion, and that is that when we look at children who grew up in high-priced housing markets, and these are children who either are in families with incomes below poverty for half of the childhood years or at twice the poverty line, so they're still poor, but they're not as poor as those below the poverty line, we find something, again, very surprising, which is that there are not big differences in the outcomes between the children growing up in the high-priced or less affordable housing market compared to those in the lower-priced markets. So the question is, well, how could we possibly find this? Well, we go back to what do we actually think is going on when we study the question of affordability. And there really are two hypotheses that seem to pertain to this question. The first is the one that I'll call the conventional hypothesis, and this is the one we're all very familiar with, and that is that if you're spending a large share of your income on housing, you're likely to not have very much left for either basic necessities or enriching kind of investments in your children, whether it's piano lessons or computers or other things. So really worrying about the resources available to the family to invest in the child. But there's also another hypothesis, which is very different, and that says that since according to economic theory, when you buy a house or pay rent, part of what you're paying for is the quality of the broader neighborhood and community environment in which you're living, which of course includes the quality of the schools, the rate of crime in the neighborhood, the kinds of enriching resources, parks and playgrounds and so on in your neighborhood. This too could be operating, and so to the extent that families are living in these higher priced markets, their children may be benefiting from these enriched amenities in those higher priced markets. And our results are really more consistent with this second hypothesis that we often don't think about than they are with the first hypothesis. It may be that both are operating, but that in fact the second are stronger than the first. And what we're doing in our continuing work is what we call stress testing these statistical models, trying many different ways of sort of looking at this problem to make sure that these findings hold up to a lot of scrutiny. And ultimately, we really want to look in a more qualitative way at particular families, choosing a small grouping of families, and actually try to tease out over the course of the child's childhood years exactly what was going on in these individual families, so that we learn something about their resourcefulness and how they make decisions and so on.
It's absolutely fascinating work, and we hope to have you back sometime in the future when you've completed this research and have some conclusive findings. Sandy Newman, Dr. Sandra Newman, Director and Professor of Policy Studies at Johns Hopkins University, thanks so much for joining us on the Affordable Housing Podcast today.
Thank you so much.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.